John Knox and Samuel Rutherford. Now, before I talk about these two men, let me make this one statement. You know, as important as the English Reformation was to the foundation of America, the Scottish Reformation had a greater impact upon the mind of North Americans and of colonialists than even the English Reformation. Though, of course, the theology of both was the same, there were some very important differences between the Reformation in Scotland and the Reformation in England. The concern of the Reformation in England was largely the rights and freedom of English free men from the tyranny of the king. The thrust of the Reformation in Scotland was the rights and prerogatives of King Jesus over his church. And if you want the best book that I know of on the Scottish Reformation, I love this book. I love the author. His name is Thomas McCree, M'Crie. He wrote a the greatest biography of John Knox. He wrote a great biography of Andrew Melville, who was the leader of the Second Scottish Reformation. And he wrote a great book called The Story of the Scottish Church, which is the story of the church in Scotland from the days of Iona all the way up until his lifetime in the early middle 1800s. It's very readable. It's full of great stories that are worth teaching your children and learning and thinking about yourself. But now we're going to talk about John Knox and Samuel Rutherford. The theology and worldview of John Calvin made an unparalleled impact on Scotland, largely through the thundering Scot, John Knox, who died in 1572. He was the paramount leader of the Scottish Reformation, about whom one said, as he stood over Knox's coffin, "Here lies one who neither feared nor flattered any flesh." Calvin said, the hero of the Scottish Reformation, the hero of the Scottish Reformation sat humbly at Calvin's feet and became more Calvinistic than Calvin. Emphasizing his central importance in the Protestant Reformation, Knox appears alongside Calvin, Farrell, and Beza in the Monument to the Reformation in Geneva, Switzerland. Although modern scholars continue to criticize Knox unjustly, leading Christian scholars have repeatedly recognized his continuing influence. I mean, if you see movies or the like, John Knox is always, like John Brown, a raging lunatic. You remember the movie on Mary Queen of Scots, an old black and white movie, where Katharine Hepburn is Mary Queen of Scots, absolutely beautiful, and she's the star of the whole movie. And Knox is in the movie, and he's this flaming lunatic. Well, that's basically the attitude that people have toward Scotland, toward Knox. Here's some other views. Calvin's death ended the pioneer period of the Reformation. Notable figures appeared later, but the foundations were laid, the theology erected, and the Calvinist structure completed, except for a tower added by the incomparable John Knox, said Otto Scott. Knox had humbled a reigning monarch, toppled a government, ousted a hierarchy, converted a people, and could regard toward the close of his life a landscape transformed by his efforts and the teaching of his mentor, Calvin. Knox's triumph in Scotland was crucial to both England, Scotland, and the British colonial world to come. John Knox is usually pictured as a crude, violent religious fanatic who tolerated no one who held to a different opinion than his own. According to the best evidence and research, he was not that kind of person at all. The famous historian and literary artist Thomas Carlyle wrote of him, "They go far wrong who think this Knox was a gloomy, spasmodic, shrieking fanatic. Not at all. He is one of the solidest men a most shrewd, observing, quietly discerning man, an honest-hearted, brotherly man, brother to high, brother also to low, sincere in sympathy with both, a cheery, social man with faces that loved him, and all an ill nature he decidedly had not. Kind, honest affections dwelt in the much enduring, hard-worn, ever-battling man. Close at hand, he was found to be no mean, acrid man, but at heart, a healthful, strong, sagacious, wise man. Knox played a major role in the English Reformation from 1549 to 1543, before he was involved in the Scottish Reformation, and that was over half of his years of public ministry. He pastored churches and was appointed royal chaplain to the godly young King Edward VI, helped Thomas Cranmer prepare the Book of Common Prayer and the 39 Articles of the Church of England, it should say, the Doctrinal Confession of the Church of England. He was offered an important bishopric and vicarage in London, which he, of course, turned down. French historian Taine said of Calvinists such as John Knox and Oliver Cromwell, "These men are the true heroes of England. They founded England in spite of the corruption of the Stuarts, by the exercise of duty, by the practice of justice, by obstinate toil, by vindication of right, by resistance to oppression, by the conquest of liberty, by the repression of vice. They founded Scotland. They founded the United States." On July the 6th, 1553, Edward VI died. And on August the 2nd, ardent Roman Catholic Bloody Mary Tudor ascended to the throne and quickly began her reign of terror against the Puritans. Cranmer himself, with many others, was martyred. A search was begun by the state for Knox, but he was able to escape England for Europe by the end of January 1554. After arriving on the continent, Knox made his way to Geneva, Switzerland, where he met and studied under John Calvin. He referred to Geneva as the most perfect school of Christ that was ever in the earth since the days of the apostles. After a short pastorate of a congregation of Marian exiles in Frankfurt, Germany, from 1554 to 1555, which was the first English Puritan church, he returned to Geneva to become the pastor of the English Puritan congregation in that city. It was members of that congregation who produced the famous Geneva Bible under the oversight of Knox and Calvin. In the meantime, the bishops in Scotland condemned him as a heretic, convicted him of failing to comply with their summons, and burned him in effigy on a cross in Edinburgh. On May the 2nd, 1559, Knox made his final return to Scotland. The situation was explosive and dangerous. Protestant nobles were courageously standing against the tyranny, superstition, and corruption of the Roman Catholic Church and for the Reformation. Riots and bloody battles broke out between the Reformed Kirk and the Scottish throne, held by Roman Catholics such as Mary Guise and Mary Queen of Scots. In 1559, a violent reaction against the Roman Catholic Church at Perth erupted among the masses, which was not condoned by Knox. Mary Guise sent in her troops and burned the city of Perth to the ground. After this, she salted the city as a warning to all those who would resist her authority. This action only provoked more fighting between the troops of the Queen Regent and the Scottish people. More and more nobles joined the Protestant cause. After destroying Perth, the Queen Regent turned her attention to the taking of St. Andrews. If she could overwhelm this Protestant stronghold, she could break the back of the Protestant rebellion. The showdown took place here. The Archbishop arrived with 100 armed men to stop Knox from preaching, but he ascended the pulpit and preached in spite of the threat. When Mary heard of it, she sent 800 French soldiers to attack and crush the rebellion. 2 days later, the French force met the congregation of the Kirk. A thick mist surrounded both groups, and under this providential cover, the congregation's forces swelled from less than 100 to 3,000 men armed to the teeth and in possession of a cannon. Needless to say, when the fog lifted and the French realized their position, they made a hasty truce. The cause of the Reformation was now on the upswing, and town after town surrendered to the congregation. John Knox began preaching at St. Giles Church in Edinburgh. His first series of sermons from the book of Haggai was a call for a complete rebuilding of the church in Scotland, patterned after the clear direction of the Word of God. Then, says David Chilton, the real work of reformation began. Catholicism was abolished, a Scots confession of faith was accepted by the Scottish Parliament, and Scotland became officially Reformed and Presbyterian. The Book of Discipline was adopted, laying down the standards for the life of the church. The effectiveness of the new Presbyterian system was so great that the savage persecutions of the following century were unable to root it out. The Reformation had come to stay. Knox continued to preach until the end, although his health was rapidly deteriorating. He grew so weak that he had to be assisted into the pulpit by several men. Once he began to speak, however, his strength would return, and he would speak with such power and vehemence that young James Melville, trying to take notes, would drop his pen in sheer fright. At times it seems, he said, as if Knox would break the pulpit in pieces and go flying out of it. Knox preached his last sermon on November 9, 1572, and afterward was escorted home by his entire church. He stayed in bed for the next 2 weeks, and on November 24th, he asked his wife to read aloud the 17th chapter of John's Gospel, where he said, quote, "I first cast my anchor." 6 hours later, he died. John Knox made several distinct contributions to the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century that have shaped Christian thought since that time. Although Knox made his own unique contributions based on the Word of God, it is obvious that the underlying influence of his life and thought was John Calvin. The written documents of Knox, with the assistance of others, that had such a reformational impact on Scotland and on the spiritual heirs of the Scottish Reformation, such as the Scotch-Irish, were the Scots Confession of Faith, Good and Godly Ballads, the Book of Discipline, which has been called the most important document in Scottish history, and the History of the Reformation in Scotland, which is suitable reading in Christian families. Here's the distinct contributions of Knox to the Protestant Reformation. First, the finality of biblical authority. All the reformers believed in the inerrancy, all-sufficiency, and final authority of the Bible as the Word of God, but no one believed it more sincerely and consistently than John Knox. The key to all of Knox's actions and beliefs is thus his strict adherence to the revealed will of God in the Bible above all else. This principle transcended any ecumenical or nationalistic concern Knox may have had. He was a man whose transcending principle was steadfast loyalty to the Word of God, not Scotland, said Richard Greaves. To quote Knox, "In the religion of God only ought his own word to be considered. Vain religion and idolatry I call whatsoever is done in God's service or honor without the express commandment of his own word." Now you'll notice I'll be quoting throughout this section a book in the footnote 61, a book by a man named Richard Greaves called Theology and Revolution in the Scottish Reformation. It's one of the best books I own. It's a paperback. It's out of print, but I would encourage you to pay whatever you have to pay to get Greaves' book. The second unique contribution or distinct contribution of Knox to the Reformation is his belief in the necessity of Christian education. In 1559, in his brief exhortation to England, Knox emphasized the necessity of Christian education for the preservation of Protestantism, urging the establishment of schools in all English cities and major towns. He also understood the danger of allowing men not devoted to biblical Protestantism to teach in the educational system. He believed that the church had the responsibility to oversee the universities and to see to it that their educational philosophy and curriculum were in accord with Christian standards. This emphasis on education was obviously the result of a Calvinistic influence. Third distinct contribution: his understanding of the responsibility of the church to the poor. Through its care of the poor and the reconstruction of education, the Scottish Church, led by John Knox, exerted a powerful influence on the entirety of Scottish society. Each local congregation was given the responsibility of providing for its own poor, with primary aid going to widows, orphans, the elderly, the disabled, and those suffering under severe financial distress. As in Geneva, the deacons were especially given the responsibility of collecting funds to disperse to the needy. Knox also encouraged the establishment of a hospital for the poor in a similar way as Calvin, who tried but did not succeed in his lifetime to establish a medical college in Geneva. The third distinct emphasis is his belief in the covenantal basis of civil government. Knox taught that a just civil government is covenantal, or federal, which comes from the word for covenantal, based on a series of covenants that define its authorities, limitations, functions, powers, and responsibilities. And he claimed to find these covenants in the Bible, which I believe he did. According to Knox, first, the civil magistrate is in covenant with God, promising to rule according to his revealed law and to oppose idolatry, 2 Kings 23. Second, the civil magistrate is in covenant with the people, promising to rule over them righteously and for their protection, 2 Chronicles 15. Third, the people are in covenant with the civil magistrate, promising to submit to his righteous government as long as he is faithful to his covenants, 2 Chronicles 15. And fourth, the people are in covenant with God, promising to be his faithful people, Exodus 34. This federal approach to civil government is the legal basis for our Declaration of Independence of 1776. Now let me go over these again, because this is brilliant. This is what we're working for. This is what we're praying will happen in this country. Again, you can see the remnants of Knoxian political theory in the fact that we speak of our national government as the federal government. And remember, the word federal means covenantal. It comes from a Latin word for covenant. So what is in Washington? The covenantal government. And a free and just civil magistrate, he said, is based upon four covenants. The first is an oath that the civil magistrate makes to God, that he will always govern under God's supremacy and according to God's law. The second covenant is the oath the civil magistrate makes to the people, promising to protect them in terms of God's law. The third covenant is the oath the people make to the civil magistrate, that they will pledge their allegiance to him as long as he's faithful to his covenants. Therein hangs a tale. And the fourth covenant is the oath the people take to God, saying, promising to be his faithful people. And Knox said these are the four covenants that are required if you're going to have a free and just civil magistrate and society. I wish I'd have brought a Declaration of Independence with me. I love it. I also love the book by Greg Singer entitled A Theological Interpretation of American History. It is the best book I know of in understanding what's happened to America through the years. It particularly had an important influence on me in my early life, but I have come to disagree with the introduction. In the introduction of A Theological Interpretation of American History by my good friend, Greg Singer, he said that whereas the Constitution was produced from a Christian perspective, the Declaration of Independence represents a humanistic, enlightenment, pagan influence. Don't agree with him at all. There is a book by another friend of mine named Gary Amos, A-M-O-S, who goes through the Declaration of Independence and shows that though it's not a perfect document, the language that we sometimes identify as Enlightenment language was typical Christian legalese in that century. For instance, the phrase, nature's nature's God and nature's, how's it go? Nature and nature's laws, God, was a legal phrase which we wouldn't agree with. We don't believe that laws come from nature. But the phrase, laws from nature and nature's God, in legal language in that century, nature's God meant the Bible. So there in the Declaration of Independence, you have the idea that laws are to be rooted in the laws of nature, which we don't agree with, and the laws of the Bible. And talks about providence, judgment, various other things like that. But the point that I'm getting at is this. Read the Declaration of Independence, and you will see there would not be such a thing without John Knox. John Knox said the people are responsible to pledge their allegiance to the civil magistrate as long as the civil magistrate is faithful to his covenant to protect them in terms of the law of God. When he breaks that covenant, said John Knox, the people are no longer accountable to obey their covenant to the civil magistrate. Now, what's the reason in the Declaration of Independence that is given for the states declaring themselves free and independent states? The despot in London has broken covenant. Read the Declaration of Independence now that you know something about Knox's covenantal politics. Also, his distinct contribution is his thought on the legitimacy of resistance against tyranny. Knox's major contribution to the Reformation and to Western civilization was his teaching on the legitimacy of resistance against tyranny, including the use of armed force by the citizenry, led by a lesser magistrate, against a tyrannical or idolatrous head of state after all other efforts have failed. Christian citizens and lesser magistrates have the duty to remove tyrants from office, according to Knox. However, armed resistance is justifiable, according to Knox, only if two preconditions have been met. The first of which was the trying of every other means, including prayer and patience. The second condition was that armed resistance must be led by legitimate lesser magistrates. Knox cited Jeremiah 37 as the scriptural basis for ministers advocating resistance against tyrannical and idolatrous authorities. However, Knox was not a revolutionary, as his life and sermons prove. Although he believed that resistance to tyranny was every Christian's duty, he could also say that we mean neither sedition, neither yet rebellion against any just and lawful authority, but only the advancement of Christ's religion and the liberty of this poor realm. In some ways, Knox more consistently applied Calvinistic principles than Calvin on a couple issues. First, Knox may have been clearer on the sufficiency of the Bible as the standard of law for civil magistrates than any of the reformers. In his The Appellation to the Nobility and Estates of Scotland, written in 1558, he wrote, listen, for it is a thing more than certain that whatsoever God required of the civil magistrate in Israel and Judah concerning the observing of true religion during the time of the law, the same doth he require of lawful magistrates professing Christ Jesus in the time of the gospel. Consider, my lords, that ye are powers ordained by God, and therefore doth the reformation of religion and the defense of such as unjustly are oppressed appertain to your charge and care, which things shall the law of God, universally given to be kept by all men, must evidently declare, which is my last and most assured reason why I say ye ought to remove from honors and to punish with death such as God hath condemned by his own mouth. You think Knox was a theonomist? Somebody wrote a paper on Knox's view of the law, and the title of it was, "Give Me That Old-Time Theonomy." Second, Knox applied the regulative principle of worship. Only what God commanded in His law is permitted in worship. If He has not commanded something, it is forbidden, more strictly than Calvin, especially in excluding from the sacrament of the Lord's Supper what was not expressly sanctioned by the Bible. In fact, Calvin wrote to Knox, April 1561, pleading with him to use discretion and be more tolerant regarding the use of extra-biblical rites and ceremonies in the worship of God. Calvin said, "The mysteries of God must be not polluted by absurd or unmeaning mixtures. With this exception, you know well that certain things, though not positively approved, must be tolerated." Knox's stricter application is similar to that of George Wishart and John Hopper, who was one of Knox's colleagues in Edwardian England. Third, Knox believed that to follow biblical precepts, he must extend the right of lawful rebellion against idolatrous and tyrannical monarchs to lesser magistrates and citizens. At first, this view was not well received outside of Scotland, but eventually it became influential. Initially, Calvin had reservations about Knox's view of lawful rebellion against tyrants, but he came to agree largely with it, so that Knox was a key link in development of political ideology that culminated in the American Revolution. Despite Calvin's written disclaimers, Calvin was by no means unsympathetic to Knox's view of resistance. Although Calvin constantly preached patience and obedience, it is also clear from his own correspondence that he did envisage the use of force, if necessary, to install Antoine de Bourbon, King of Navarre, in power at the end of 1560. In 1561, he published a lecture on Daniel 6:22, Calvin did, which sanctioned popular defiance against princes who opposed God. He wrote, "Earthly princes lay aside all their power when they rise up against God and are unworthy of being reckoned in the number of mankind. We ought rather utterly to defy than to obey them whenever they are so restive and wish to spoil God of His rights." This is Calvin. Since this position was taken by Calvin in the aftermath of the successful Scottish Revolution, there is the possibility that he was influenced by Knox. As his reaction to the Amboy conspiracy indicates, however, he was reluctant to practice his theory. After 1562, his reluctance waned somewhat, for he helped raise funds to support the Huguenot cause. David Chilton summarizes the abiding contributions of the life and theology of John Knox. Knox's continuing contribution is not just that of the Kirk of Scotland, which after four centuries still uses his Order of Geneva in worship, nor is it just that of a nation freed from bondage to sin, ignorance, and statist tyranny. It is rather his firm insistence and lifelong demonstration that all men are religious in every aspect of life, and that no institution, high or low, can be separated from its responsibility to God, that the greatest liberty is found in the greatest subservience to God's law, that there is one supreme king before whom all others must bow. And then there's Samuel Rutherford. A second wave of reformation hit Scotland in the late 16th and early 17th centuries under the leadership of such men as Andrew Melville, Robert Bruce, Alexander Henderson, and Samuel Rutherford. Rutherford has been described as one of the most extraordinary men in an age of heroes. After the death of Alexander Henderson in 1646, the mantle of leadership in the Scottish Church fell on Samuel Rutherford. One minister who knew him said of him, "I never knew one in Scotland like him. He seemed to be always praying, always preaching, always visiting the sick, always teaching in the schools, always writing treaties, always reading and studying." Rutherford was a Covenanter. Covenanters were those thousands of Scottish Christians who covenanted together to stand for Christ as the head of the church and for the purity of the Reformed faith in the doctrine, worship, government, and discipline of the Church of Scotland, even in the face of the threats of the tyrannical Scottish and English thrones, regardless of the cost. These two historic covenants are the National Covenant of 1638 and the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643. As a result, between 1660 and 1688, thousands upon thousands of covenanting men, women, and children, including entire congregations, were tortured and martyred by the crown. These have been called the killing times, and the capital crime they were accused of was attending an unregistered Presbyterian church. Besides being an official commissioner from Scotland to the Westminster Assembly in the mid-1640s, which produced the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechism, Samuel Rutherford authored a famous book that was a bestseller in the American colonies in 1776, and which is still being published today. That book, whose Latin title is Lex Rex, translated means "The Law is King," was written in answer to the dictum of Charles I, "Rex Lex, the King is Law." This work marked Rutherford as one suspected of treason by the supporters of the Stuart monarchy. It was burned by the public hangman, and Rutherford himself was found guilty of treason by the drunken parliament. Lex Rex was still shaping opinion over a century after it was written. The attestation of the popularity of Lex Rex in the colonies is significant, for it indicates that Rutherford's political philosophy was in the mainstream of Puritan political thought. There was nothing unusual, peculiar, extremist, or reactionary in Lex Rex, as far as the Westminster divines were concerned. Its roots were in the political thought of Martin Bucer, John Calvin, and Theodore Beza. And the best 25 or 30 page review of Lex Rex that I know of is called Samuel Rutherford and the Puritan Political Theory, written by Richard Flynn, the uncle of Candace's husband. Now, in 1776, the Lex Rex was popular. Two of the best sellers in 1776 were Vindicii Contra Tyrannis and Lex Rex in the colonies. They loved them. And they both were Calvinistic books. And they both represented mainstream religion in the colonies. There was nothing extreme about them. This is what the average American believed in 1776. That's why Lex Rex was still popular 100 years after it was written. Now let me tell you three things it taught. And this was mainstream. This was consensus of opinion. One, only God can distinguish good from evil. And he has done so in the Bible. Leave it up to man to distinguish good from evil and to call evil good and good evil. Nothing particularly radical about that, is there? One, only God can determine good and evil, and he has done so in the Bible. Two, he said only God can define a criminal act, and he has done so in the Bible. You leave it up to man to define what's criminal, and he will become absurd and arbitrary. He'll arrest the protester and let the abortionist go free. The third is only God can define how crime can be punished justly, and he's done so in the Bible. Leave it up to man to define how crime is to be punished, and his punishment will be barbaric and inhumane. Hinckley, who attempted the assassination of Reagan, instead of being executed, is still being housed and fed by your tax money in a hospital. So those are the three of the fundamental principles of Lex Rex. Only God can distinguish good from evil, and he's done so in the Bible. Only God can define a criminal act, and he has done so in the Bible. And only God can define how crime is to be punished justly, and he's done so in the Bible. See anything unusual about those? If you believe those three principles, you are a tiny minority of Christians in America in the 21st century. And if most of your Christian friends and relatives find out that you believe those three things, they will look at you with the worst anger and disgust. Because what I just said in these three principles is the heart of theonomy. Only God can distinguish good from evil, and he's done so in the Bible. Only God can define a criminal act, and he's done so in the Bible. Only God can define how crime is to be punished, and he's done so in the Bible. That was the consensus of opinion in colonial America, reflected in the fact that Lex Rex was a bestseller then. 485, first full paragraph. The central emphases of Rutherford's Lex Rex are these. By the way, I've preached this sermon three times in front of the grave of Samuel Rutherford. The central emphases of Rutherford's Lex Rex are these. One, tyrannical princes were to be resisted by the people who represent a higher authority than the king. But by people, Rutherford meant the elected representative body of the people, not the masses. He believed in republicanism, not democracy. Second, the civil magistrate is God's minister and God's deputy. Third, civil magistrates, including kings, are to be elected by the people. Now, the king didn't like that too much. That's one of the reasons they burned his books. And if you can find a mint copy, a first edition of Lex Rex, you've got a fortune. Becky's brother owns one. Civil magistrates, including kings, are to be elected by the people, as were the kings of Israel in the Old Testament. Most Christians today don't even know the kings of Israel in the Old Testament were elected by the people. The only times they weren't is when Israel was under the thumb of some pagan nation and they would impose petty kings upon Israel. Other than that, God called the kings, the people elected them. Four, since only God can bind men to guilt and punishment, the civil magistrate is absolutely bound to the direction of the Creator in the way he wields that sword. The moral system that defines guilt and transgression is God's law in the Bible. Thus, says Archie Jones, recognition of the validity of biblical law established the validity of resistance to tyrants. It also established the validity of the practices of interposition and nullification by lesser magistrates of unjust laws promulgated by central authorities. It is only with middle and later 19th and 20th century humanistic absolutism in American legal and political thought and practice that these biblical principles and God-given duties have been obscured and denied. It is a powerful testimony to the strength and endurance of Christian influence in American legal and political thought that what Europe and England experienced in the 16th century, the Enlightenment, we did not experience as a powerful intellectual and social force until the late 19th century. In conclusion, Egbert Smith is exactly correct when he writes, when Calvinism reached the Scottish people, they were vassals of the Roman Church, priest-ridden, ignorant, wretched, degraded in body, mind, and morals. Marvelous was the transformation when the great doctrines learned by Knox from the Bible in Scotland and more thoroughly at Geneva while sitting at the feet of Calvin flashed in upon their minds. It was like the sun arising at midnight. Knox made Calvinism the religion of Scotland, and Calvinism made Scotland the moral standard for the world.